Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Ofcom call to discuss promoting competition and investment in fiber networks. The call is being hosted by Melanie Dawes, Ofcom Chief Executive. My name is Ben and I'm your event manager. I would like to advise all parties this conference is being recorded for replay purposes, which will be available later on together with the transcript of the call on the Ofcom website. And now I would like to hand over to Rohit Goyal, Ofcom's analyst and investor relations manager.
Great. Thank you, Ben, and good morning to you all. With me this morning are Melanie Dawes, Ofcom Chief Executive, Lindsay Fussell, Group Director of Networks and Communications, and David Clarkson, Director of Networks and Communications. Through the presentation portion of this call, we'll be referring to the accompanying slides, which you can download if you've not already done so from the analyst presentation section of the Ofcom website. There'll be an opportunity to ask questions once we've completed the presentation. And with that, I'd like to hand over to Melanie.
Thank you very much, Rohit, and welcome everybody to this morning's call. Thank you very much for joining us. It's an important day for Ofcom today. We've announced, as you know, our final decisions on how we're going to be regulating wholesale fixed telecoms in the year ahead. And in a moment, I'll pass over first to Lindsay Fussell, who's our Group Director for Communications and Networks, and then to David Clarkson, who is our Director for Fixed Telecoms and who has led our work on the access review. So just to give you a bit of an introduction, and I'm now looking at slide two of the slides for those of you who are using the slides, just to say a little bit about what we're aiming for and what we're trying to achieve from Ofcom. So the important thing to say is that we know now that broadband services are ever more important, not just for the economy and for businesses, but actually to how we live our home lives as well. And we've really had that brought home to all of us, I think, in the past year, and it's not going away anytime soon. So the need for really high-quality broadband is absolutely essential to every part of UK life. And so what our approach is aiming to achieve is to encourage investment in the new fibre networks that, as you know, we will need into the future. And we know that this is not just another upgrade. It's a long-term investment where the returns will take a decade or more to pay back, and we understand that, and we've built that into our approach. And it is, in the end, about replacing the decades-old copper networks that we've relied on for so long and that actually we've sweated as assets to give a super-fast broadband across 96% of the country, but we know that's not good enough for the future. We need fibre optic cable to reach right into the home in order to give us not just the speed, but also the reliability. And as you know, central to our approach is to incentivise investment, of course, from BT, and I think, as you hear our the final decisions in a moment, we're aiming to make sure that they have a fair bet, that we honour the fair bet and allow them the opportunity to earn a fair return above their normal cost of capital over the duration of this investment. But it's also about incentivising others into the market too. Ultimately, what we're aiming for is for consumers to have a choice of networks so that they have choices on pricing, but also so that they can, so we can really get competition for quality and for service levels as well. And if we do see that market growing, then we will be able to step back from regulating much more in the future, which I think is what everybody would ideally like to see. So on that note, I'm going to pass over now to Lindsay, who will take you through the next bit of the presentation.
Thank you, Melanie. I'm going to outline the key decisions that we're announcing today. As Melanie has already said, this is a pro-investment, pro-competition strategy, and we believe it will support the rollout of gigabit capable networks to around 80% of the UK on a commercial basis. And public funding will be needed to support the rollout to the final 20%, but as you know, the government has already announced its intentions here. So I'm now on to slide three for those of you who are following it. So turning first to our pricing decisions. This is a significant departure to the pricing approach that we've taken in previous market reviews. So firstly, we have stepped away from cost-based pricing, which we have done in previous pricing reviews, and today we announced that we're indexing prices of the lower speed products, those at 40/10 and below, to CPI. For higher speed products, we continue to allow pricing flexibility for Openreach. And importantly, where a customer chooses to take a lower speed product, 40/10, over an FTTP line, we will allow Openreach to charge a premium to reflect the superior quality and reliability of the service that that customer will get because they will be using FTTP, and that premium is £1.70 per month. These decisions give BT and the other investors the margin they need to invest and support competition at the wholesale level. We've taken the approach in our review, as you know, to divide the country into different geographic areas. So what we call Area 2, which we see as areas where there's a prospect of material competition at scale, and Area 3, where we see this as less likely, in other words, in more rural areas. As BT has committed to building to 3.2 million premises in Area 3, we have been able to extend the same pricing decisions across all parts of the UK, and that gives really helpful consistency of regulation to BT, and also supports smaller networks who may want to build in rural areas. As Melanie has said, this is a long-term commitment. We've said today that we do not expect to reintroduce cost-based pricing in either Area 2 or 3 until 2031 at the earliest. Secondly, we're confirming proposals today to enable Openreach to switch off the existing copper network, area by area, once the fibre network is built out. And this is clearly not only more efficient for Openreach because it won't need to be running two networks at once, but it also supports their business case, de-risks that business case by promoting uptake of fibre. We believe these decisions provide the regulatory enablers that BT have asked for and give them what they need to be able to invest in full fibre. But we also have to hold BT to account to do their part to make the strategy work, the competitive strategy overall. So we continue to require Openreach to support alternative networks builders by making available their ducts and poles. This process has significantly improved, and there has been a huge amount of uptake in the use of ducts and poles in the past year, despite, in fact, all the lockdowns and the challenges. But we will be continuing to maintain a really close eye on this. We're also expecting Openreach to maintain quality of service standards on its copper networks, because we know that millions of consumers will continue to rely on those networks over the coming years. So our statement also sets out the quality of service standards that Openreach will be held to over the next 5 years. Thanks. I'm going to now hand over to Dave, who's going to talk a little bit more about how our decision to support investment by both BT and other network builders.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. Moving on to slide 4, where I'll talk a little bit about regulation to support investment by Openreach and others. So this is just a little bit more detail on top of what Lindsay has just set out. So central to our regulatory structure is access to BT's ducts and poles, such that BT's competitors, other operators, can also roll out fibre networks faster without having to dig up the road multiple times. So that's our central part. Then in terms of our pricing, and I'll just go through these very quickly. So indexation for the entry level 40 meg product. So that will say flat in real terms, going up with CPI. We think that this actually leaves margin in the system for BT and others to invest. Not only does it allow BT to invest, but it should also allow them to accelerate the depreciation of the copper assets to avoid stranded assets. The other one is on pricing flexibility for the higher speed services. So these are those services that the new networks are able to support. And what we would want is we'd want the investors building these networks to be able to set the prices for these so they can try and sort of gain a premium and get a fair return on those investments. The premium for FTTP, so this is, it's tied in with the copper switch off, which I'll move on to in a minute, and this is where BT replaces its network with fibre and it moves customers onto it, and they are still taking that entry level 40 meg product. They can do so with a regulated price, but that price will be £1.70 more per month compared with the copper services. And that's to reflect the extra value that that service brings, not just to consumers, but actually in the supply chain, as it should lead to lower faults and therefore lower maintenance issues. A very key part of this structure is the copper switch off. You know, different than all other broadband upgrades in the last two decades, this is really a replacement of the copper network. And once the new network has been built, it is obviously sensible if we can close the old network down, avoid the duplication of cost of running the old and the new networks, and also get a customer base on the new network. And what we've set out here is we've set out a staged approach to rollback regulation in area by area, and those areas are the BT Exchange footprints as BT builds its new network. The last two boxes that are on this slide is about us ensuring that we give support to competitors over the coming years. You know, there is quite a lot of competitive activity in the market at the moment, but it is still quite nascent, and these competitors are still quite small. And we would not want to see pricing practices which could inadvertently hamper the establishment of those competitors. And so what we've done here is on geographic pricing, so this is the very targeted local pricing that maybe BT or Openreach could do. We've said that by default that should be prohibited. However, we do recognise that there could be cases where it is in fact necessary and is justified, and so we put a process in place where Openreach can ask for consent on those cases. For other types of contract, like long duration contracts and volume discounts, we're conscious that these could be an issue. We have not prohibited them. Rather, we've actually said that there should be a 90-day notice period so that us and the rest of the industry have an opportunity to look at those before they come into effect. Lindsay mentioned it earlier. The approach we're taking, although we do see differences in different parts of the country in terms of competitive conditions and our Area 2 and Area 3, in light of the Openreach commitment to build 3.2 million in our Area 3, the more rural areas, we've actually set the same regulatory approach to pricing across both those areas. So we have a consistency. We see this as being very useful from a consumer point of view, also from an investor point of view, because, you know, if we're honest, we're trying to set this boundary today for 5 years in the future, and we know that we probably won't get it precisely right. And having the same regulation in both areas will actually mitigate any effects if it isn't in the right place. Moving on to slide 5. A big part of this is how we might regulate in the future and the fair bet. We are conscious that these are big investments and their payback periods are very long term. And so we feel that it's right that we go the extra mile and set out how we will regulate in the future. What we've actually set out here today is we've said that based on the information currently available to us in terms of rollout plans and government intervention, we don't expect to go back to cost-based controls, price controls, for at least 10 years, taking us out to 2031. In saying that, we are not saying that in 10 years' time we will definitely go back to cost-based controls. We're saying that actually, you know, we'll get to that point and see what's happening in the market. And we set this out in the document, but our thought process and approach here, which we've put down in the document, is, of course, we would like there to be competition that's actually developed as a result of this. And if that is the case, actually, we will be stepping back from regulation altogether and letting the market take over. And that's where we would like to get to. Of course, it could be that in 10 years' time, we don't have established competition, but there is still ongoing investment and competition. In that case, we are saying that we would look to regulate at that time in a way that would continue to support this. If we find that, in fact, investment and competition potential has dried up at that time, that again, that doesn't necessarily mean that we would go straight into cost-based controls. Instead, we would look for market outcomes. What's the outcome for the consumers? Is Openreach doing good deals with its customers, the ISPs? And particularly, because we know that we are going to see differences in competition across the country, something that we've laid out here is, if we have some areas that are competitive and some areas that are not competitive, provided the consumers in the not competitive areas are receiving the same deals, the same products and prices as those available in the competitive areas, that is going to make us much less likely to want to intervene because their consumers would be getting good outcomes. Finally, of course, there is a possibility that we might need to set cost-based controls in the future, and we set out in this document how we would go about that to ensure that the fair bet is honoured. And we are saying that we will actually look at the investments taken, the risks faced at the time, what the cost of capital was at the time and ensure that the returns earned had sufficiently rewarded those risks. We actually set out some detail of the mechanics of how we would do this and depreciate the investment itself, such that any upsides earned in the early parts of the investment cycle before regulation could be kept and enjoyed, and any returns after that, of course, we would give the opportunity to earn the cost of capital. Thus, overall, over the whole investment cycle, there is a good opportunity to earn a return above the cost of capital. And we set this out in some detail in Volume 4 of the document. I'm going to hand back now to Melanie, and I think we're going to get ready to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Dave and Lindsay, and I'll just wrap up the presentation now, looking at our final slide, our conclusions, and just to bring home once again some of the things we're trying to do here. This is very much about a framework that's pro-investment and pro-competition. We know that means it needs to be a long-term framework. We're providing more long-term certainty and direction, I think, than Ofcom's ever managed to achieve before. And as a result of that, we do think the investment case has never been more clear or more compelling. We think we've addressed the regulatory enablers for BT and provided a clear path to honour the fair bet with the opportunity to earn a return that's fair above the normal cost of capital. And there's a good offer here for challengers through access to ducts and poles and also by our wider pricing decisions. So, we'll open it up now for questions. I think I'm going to hand over to Rohit to help us through that, but also to our BT operator, Ben, who I think will steer us through. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Melanie. So before we move to questions, I should say that we've got a large number of participants on the call. So if you don't get an opportunity to ask, then please do get in touch with me, Rohit Goyal. So it's analyst.relations@ofcom.org.uk. I would ask that if you could please keep questions to today's announcement and pick up any other matters with myself after the call. Ben, we're now ready to take questions, please.
Thank you very much. So everyone, your question and answer session will now begin. If you would like to ask a question, just key star 1 on your telephone. If you would like to withdraw your question, you can key star 2. So star 1 to ask a question and star 2 to withdraw it. Thank you. The first incoming question is coming from the line of Carl Murdoch-Smith from Berenberg. Please proceed, your line is open.
Hi, good morning, and congratulations on finally getting there with this review. I suppose my question would just be on in terms of what would you point to as the main differences in today's statement versus the consultation at the beginning of last year? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the question. I'm going to pass that one over to Dave.
Thank you very much for the congratulations. You're right, it's been a long journey for us. In terms of the main differences, you know, to be absolutely honest, there's not a lot of differences compared to the consultation. You know, we spent a long time getting to the consultation, and the process started back in early part of 2018. So the main components you will see here are very much the same in terms of the indexation, the price flexibility, and the premium. There is a little bit more detail around the copper switch off, of course, that we've set out here. But I think probably the biggest new thing in the document, of course, is how clearly we've actually set out the future regulation and the fair bet. And I know that we've discussed this in various calls with yourself in the past, and we've taken the feedback that you've given us on that, and we absolutely do recognise the scale and the length of these investments, And quite unusually for us, we took the decision to actually be explicit about how we will be regulating, or how we intend to regulate out over the next decade, and in fact beyond. So I think that really is the main differences that I would point to.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Dave, and congrats again.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much. I think we can take our next question, Ben, if anyone else has got a question for us.
Of course. The next question is coming from the line of James Retzer from New Street Research. Please proceed. Your line is open.
Yes, good morning, Melanie and team. Thank you. Yes, I'd two questions, please. Just the first one was, would just love to hear a little bit more on the detail around the kind of long-term contracts and geographic pricing flexibility. If Openreach did come to you and said they had a proposal with an ISP for a long-term bulk volume discount contract, or to ask for geographic discounting in a certain area, what would be the key metrics you'd be kind of judging on to kind of judge those proposals? And secondly, I'd just like to understand in practice the economic depreciation term you refer to, you know, when you talk about assessing the fair bet beyond 2030, that you'd look at, I think, just the economic depreciation of the assets rather than the accounting depreciation. Could you again just explain a little bit more how that might work? That imply by 2030 only a tiny fraction of the current assets would be depreciated? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the questions. I'll pass those over to Dave and Lindsay, who are in a room together, and I'll leave you to work out who's going to answer which one.
No problem, Melanie. I'll answer the question on long-term contracts, and then I'll hand over to Dave on economic depreciation, if that's okay. So on long-term contracts, as Dave said, we have prohibited geographic pricing as part of the review, but we have said that if BT do have proposals, we will look at those and be prepared to consider them. So it's not an absolute prohibition if they come up with something that we think looks sensible. And the reason for that is what we're concerned about is that whilst we're very confident about the prospects of competition in this market, we do know that it's nascent and it's early. And if BT choose to geographically price off a discounts in areas where new competitors are just in the early stages of their building, that could have a really detrimental impact on the competition really early on. So that's the kind of thing that we will be particularly concerned about on geographic pricing. As I say, there may be occasions where we will be prepared to relax that. We have, for example, already offered BT some flexibility in the trial areas in Salisbury and Mildenhall. Going on to other kinds of long-term contracts that don't involve a geographic element, we have taken a bit of a different approach here, so those aren't banned. We've said that BT just need to notify us 90 days in advance. We will have a look at them, give us and others in the market the chance to look at it beforehand. And I think what we'll be thinking about there is, you know, what is the impact here on that competition? I think it's quite possible to think of some long-term deals that BT might want to offer to its CPs, for example, discounts to get them to move their customers from STDC up to the full fibre product. But what we would obviously be concerned about is if those deals required the CPs to keep large amounts of volume with BT, thus preventing them from the other competitors from competing for the business of those CPs.
Okay, thank you, Lindsay. I guess I'll just add a couple of things to that. So obviously, the main thing that we'd be looking at is to ensure that actually any pricing deals don't unfairly undermine new competition. I know that the document is big that we've put out today, so I can point you at volume 3, and there is a section in there which goes into this detail, and that sets it all out for you. On our point about economic appreciation, so this is in the event, and I did lay out that there are many reasons that we might not get here, but this is in the event that we do have to set cost-based controls in the future. And of course, we know that the cash flows of these investments are going to be negative for a long, long time in terms of cash flow. There's going to be a lot of investment going in and not much revenue coming out in the short term, because obviously as volumes grow and so on. So what we're saying is that when we look at this investment, rather than do this accounting depreciation, which just depreciates possibly a proportion of it each year, we would do an economic depreciation. And what we're really looking at there is we're going to be looking at the revenue earning potential of the asset rather than just time. And of course, in the early years, you know, because the network's new and you probably don't have many customers on it, its revenue earning potential is much, much lower than it will be in the later years when the network's full. And consequently, that means that we would actually be looking to actually depreciate the asset slower in the early years. And obviously, that means that we would be depreciating it much faster in the later years, or leaving more of the assets for the later years. And that's important for giving certainty to the investment, because what we're then saying is, should we actually regulate in the later years at cost, we would do so on the basis of actually having quite a lot of the asset base still remaining, because that's what economic depreciation would do. And in doing it this way, any upsides earned against a low depreciation in the early part of the investment cycle can actually be kept, and we can leave that to BT or whoever. So that sort of is our thinking on economic depreciation. And again, I could point you to Volume 4, Section 1, where we go into the detail of that as well. So it's in the documents, and obviously after this call, you can get in touch with us, and we're happy to provide more information if necessary.
Great, that's really clear. Thank you.
Sorry. Yes, then we can have our next question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next question is coming from the line of Maurice Patrick from Barclays. Please proceed. Your line is open.
Yeah, morning, guys. It's Maurice here from Barclays. Thanks for hosting the call today. Much appreciated. So one of the questions investors ask is the certainty returns, and I know you've tried to address it today. But just to understand, in the document you talk about if there isn't infrastructure competition, then you would look to price regulate. Or likely to price regulate, focus on cost-based returns. But you also say in the presentation, look, if some areas are competitive and some areas aren't, then if consumer pricing isn't different, then we're less likely to intervene. It seems should we interpret that therefore as if there's infra competition in some places and not others, then in the areas that there isn't, you wouldn't necessarily price regulate, even though in the document it seems like you said you would do.
And I'll ask Dave to come in on that in a moment. But, you know, I think the overall philosophy here is that, you know, absolutely we're looking for market conditions as our trigger for how we regulate in the future. And if there is competition, or even if there's competition emerging, then we would look not to regulate if we can. It'll all be about what's there, what's available to the consumer, and how the overall setup is working for them. But Dave, do you want to answer that specific question? And I should just say, by the way, that we're very aware that obviously it's a very long document. So, you know, if it's helpful for us to flag particular pages that you can look at, then we can do so either after the presentation or during it, as Dave's already been doing. Dave, over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. So, I mean, in terms of our future approach, I mean, you know, the way I see this, and I think the way that we have tried to set it up in the document, is we're going into this with a mindset that we hope we don't have to go into price regulation. And so we're looking for all of the things that would help us get to that position, if you like. And the first one is, of course, if we get competition, absolutely we shouldn't go for price regulation. You know, but of course, and the point that you ask about, you know, that in some areas we're certainly not going to get competition, we know that, and in other areas we would. And here what we're saying is it's sort of what's known as the common pricing constraint. If we found that the customers in the areas where there wasn't competition were getting the same products and the same prices as those in the competitive areas, then we are likely to be satisfied that actually they're getting a fair outcome, and that is going to make it much less likely that we are going to want to do price regulation. And you know, we may still regulate in terms of access because there isn't competition, but actually we could be much lighter touch in our regulation. And this is also set out in volume 4, section 1, where we talk about pricing. So that's the area. And you know, we'd very much like to get to that place because, you know, our primary objective is getting these networks built for consumers and then ensuring that consumers get good products and a good deal on the back of them.
That's great. Thank you, guys.
Over for our next question then, Ben. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next question is coming from the line of Jeremy Dallas from Jefferies. Please proceed. Your line is open.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my questions. I have two questions, please. Firstly, what would you define as being BT's cost of capital on the FTTP build, please? I think you refer to a cost of capital for the other UK telecom segment in volume 4, but it'd be interesting for you to spell out precisely, please, where you think BT's cost of capital is on the fibre project specifically. And then secondly, if you do find yourself having to intervene to implement price controls, what target return on BT's fibre investment would you have in mind? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the question. Dave, over to you again, I think.
Okay, thank you, Mary. I'll certainly pick up the first one of those and maybe hand it to Lindsay. So, in this document, you know, we have consciously, in fact, not set out what we think the FTTP WACC is at this stage in time. You know, what we have set out in the document is we set out what we think the group WACC is and how we would subdivide that into the different areas of Openreach, other UK telcos, and the rest of BT. Now, the only number that we actually use to set any prices in this review is actually the Openreach number, where we set the prices for dark fibre and for duct and pole access. So our reasons for not trying to tease out an FTTP WACC is simply because we're not using it at this point in time and we don't want to send people off in certain directions. Instead, you know, the way that we would like to look at this and the way that we've set it out in the document is, should we need to regulate in the future, what we would be doing is we would be going back and looking at the points in time where the investments were made and what the appropriate WACC was at that time and what the risk was at that time. So that's how we would actually do it. I mean, you know, So we haven't actually set out a number, and I'm not going to try to, but clearly the number will be somewhere north of the rest of UK telcos because it would be a risk premium on top of that figure.
Thanks, Dave. And just to sort of pick up the second point a bit more on sort of target return, I think the first thing, as we said, is that, you know, we do see this as an entirely different kind of framework to build an entirely new network. So we are hoping that it's competition that's going to be determining the level of commercial return that any player, including BT, gets. And as Dave just set out in answer to the previous question, you know, our bias here will be against intervention and letting that competition play out for as long as we can. If we do get to the point that we think that we need to re-enter and look again at pricing, I think, you know, as Dave just said, firstly, we'll look at the risks that BT faced at the point that they made the decision to invest, and secondly, the cost of capital that existed at that time. And what we will look to satisfy ourselves is that the amount of returns that BT have earned during the investment have satisfied or above compensate them for the level of risk that they've faced. We will definitely allow them to keep the upside that they've gained up till that point and then look to regulate the rest of the cycle so that they earn above the cost of capital over the investment cycle as a whole.
So historically, you've tended to allow a 300 to 400 basis point return above cost of capital. Would that be the sort of benchmark you would have in mind?
And I think, as I say, we're not setting a target return at this point, but I think it's a fair comment to say that historically we have allowed BT to keep returns around 3 to 4% above the cost of capital. And I think, you know, we've got a good track record of making making sure that the fair bet is honoured in that way.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that very important set of questions. Over to the next one, please, Ben.
Thank you. The next question is coming from the line of Nick Delfas from Redburn. Please proceed. Your line is open.
Yeah, thanks very much. Just to follow up on Jerry's question, I mean, obviously you hope that there won't be any need for price regulation in the 2030s, but could you just clarify what we're talking about here in terms of a fair bet return? Are you talking about an IRR whereby you have the cash outflows from investment, the inflows, and then the terminal value is the asset base with economic depreciation versus accounting depreciation, and you'll look at that IRR, you'll compare it to the WACC, which you're not telling us what you think it is today, but it's a figure that's that is set asset today rather than asset in 2030, and you'll allow an excess return over that WACC. Is that the way we should be thinking about what you believe the fair bet is? Thanks.
Okay, I think I'll pick up that question. I think broadly how you just set that out is how we see it. So effectively, we would be looking at the return over the entire investment cycle, so the entire sort of economic life of the investment and the assets, if you like. And what we would be doing is we would be looking at all of those years before any regulation of prices coming, and looking at what the sort of returns were there, what were the risks, was there reasonable compensation, and then we would be looking to ensure that we set up any charge controls such that any sort of returns above WACC would then be enshrined and kept. For the second half, if you like, of the investment cycle, where a charge control would exist, we would be setting that up in our normal way to ensure that BT was able to earn its normal cost of capital. The point then being is that the returns over the entire investment cycle will be above the cost of capital, because we'll have the period before investment, before regulation rather, that should exceed the cost of capital to cover the risk and reward the risk, and then the returns after the point of intervention, which should allow the normal cost of capital. Thus, overall, the returns for the entire investment cycle would be above the cost of capital.
So just to clarify, I mean, obviously the part that we're interested in particular is, or at least the part that there's been a history of, is the part until economic regulation kicks in, when, as Jerry was saying, you know, people are expecting a few hundred basis points excess return over WACC before regulation. And then the second part is during economic regulation, where obviously returns will be much closer to WACC. Is that's the right way of thinking about it?
Well, certainly, what we'd be setting up, you know, from the point of any intervention would be to ensure cost of capital. Up to that point, you know, we're not actually coming out with a predefined figure here. Actually, we're saying, you know, basically it's up to you and the market. You know, you can sort of attempt to make as much as you like, and the more efficient you are in doing this, the more you potentially could make. And we're not saying that, you know, if it's one or two or three, we're saying, you know, whatever you can do in the market over the next 10 or whatever years, you know, it's up to you. You know, and then what we're saying is that what we're then going to do is we're going to say, look, we're not going to try and claw that back in any way. We're going to try and ensure that that can be kept through the way that any subsequent intervention takes place.
Okay, very clear. Thanks so much indeed.
Thanks very much. So, next question. If we may.
The next question is coming from the line of Robert Grindle from Deutsche Bank. Please proceed, your line is open.
Yeah, good morning and thanks everyone. PIA is a large part of encouraging alt fiber build in your document this morning. Some gripes from the industry, but does Ofcom view that the current PIA setup pretty much does what it needs to do, or does it need tweaks from here? And second question is, Separately, I attended some of the project rollout conference yesterday. Some of the operators are saying that both regulator and government underestimate the demand for alt operators to build in Area 3. My question is, are you just being consistently surprised about the level of interest from the altnet providers, be it in rural or urban? Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Just to say, on your second point, I mean, it's great that we're hearing that there's even more appetite for commercial build, even in some of the more some of the less competitive areas. So I'll leave my colleagues to say more about that and how it fits in with what the government's doing. But I think that's really good news, actually. On PIA, again, Dave may want to say a bit more. I mean, look, I chair on a quarterly basis a meeting to oversee how we're doing on PIA, and all of the CEOs from the altnets can come. Openreach are there. We're holding them to account for how the system's working. And of course, look, this is challenging because by its very nature, and Openreach would be the first people to say this, you know, this is an old set of systems, an old set of ducts and poles with lots of issues with weather and water logging and so on. And so in a way, what people are seeing into is quite some of the operational issues that, you know, Openreach deal with day by day. So we're working through all those, though, or Openreach and others are working through those. And actually what's been quite exciting is that in the last year, we've seen a big increase now in the take-up of duct and poles. It's around tenfold over the last 12 months. So we will remain absolutely on this. It will remain a priority for me. It's a really important part of the system. It's operationally complicated, but it's beginning to come through. But I would expect people to be constantly, you know, wanting more and, you know, complaining a little bit around the edges. And we've set up a system to allow that to happen so that we can hear the problems and then get Openreach and others onto resolving them as quickly as possible. Dave, do you want to come in on that or on the question about Area 3?
Well, I was pretty much going to cover what you said. It appears that you've now become an expert in ducts and poles in your year with us, so you've pretty much covered all of it. So that covers it all. I mean, look, PIA is not straightforward. It will constantly evolve because that is the nature of it. But we do have an industry working group set up. We have our telecoms adjudicator that's overseeing it. As you just heard, Melanie herself is chairing these sessions every 3 months. It does appear to have improved, and it's in a reasonable place, you know, but let's not be complacent. There will always be improvements that can be made as we go forwards, and we're expecting to work alongside the telecoms adjudicator and industry to make sure that those improvements happen.
And just to add, if you want some stats on that, we have had a huge increase in the use of duct and pole in the past year. So this year we've seen providers ordering around 23,000 kilometres of duct usage and 140,000 poles to deploy their networks. And when we look at those figures from May 2019, it was only 2,500 kilometres and 12,000 poles. So you can see there's been a huge increase in that, and that gives us a lot of confidence that the system is becoming increasingly fit for purpose and really effective for providers to use. On the question on Area 3, I mean, look, I think, you know, we're delighted to see that there is all sorts of different companies thinking about building both in Area 2 and 3. In relation to Area 3, of course, we're not yet certain that there will be a scale competitor to Openreach. That seems a bit less likely than in Area 2. But the great thing is that because we have been able to apply the same pricing and regulatory consistency across the whole of the UK, that gives those altnets the same, you know, margin and advantage to build as altnets building in Area 2. So we think that gives them the best chance to be successful.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the questions. You can tell we're quite enthusiastic about PIA. When Dave calls me an expert, I know I really do have something to be proud of. But I think we'll move on to our next question, if that's okay.
The next question is coming from the line of Polo Cheng from UBS. Please proceed, your line is open.
Morning, everybody. So just two quick questions. The first one is, can I just clarify the point on long-term contracts for Openreach? So are you basically saying that anything involving minimum volume commitments on FTTP are not allowed because you're concerned about it impacting emerging competition? So that's the first question. And the second question is really just about market structure. If you fast forward to 2031, what's your view on what the UK fibre market would look like if regulation, fibre regulation, is working the way you want it to? So specifically, how big a role do you think players such as Virgin Media and outlets like CityFibre and Hyperoptic will play in the new fibre landscape? Thanks.
Thanks very much for the question. I'll ask Lindsay or Dave to come in again on the first, and also perhaps to follow up on the second. I mean, on your second point, the headlines are that overall we think that what we're deciding, what we're announcing today by way of our decisions, will support about 70% of the country having a choice of networks over the next sort of 5 years or so. And then once you add in Openreach's commitment in more rural areas, which covers another 10%, you then get to the 80% commercial build, and beyond that it's about government coming in and subsidising the build in the way that we're familiar with. But Dave and Lindsay, do you want to follow up on that and on the first question?
Yeah, okay, I'll pick up the pricing question. So, I mean, look, There are lots of different pricing structures and that could be adopted, and you know, and we're very conscious that some of them will be really good for promoting the take up of fibre, and in fact we want to encourage them, and that's indeed the reason that that we're not looking to put a prohibition on these pricing structures, and instead saying, well, let's look at what's in the art of the possible here, you know. But of course, we are conscious that there is a line in there that could be crossed, that actually could undermine some nascent competition, and it's really that line that we just need to avoid crossing. We actually think that there are many pricing structures that will be acceptable and will be good to promote the take up of FTTP. And in fact, there are several already in the market, you know, and we don't have a problem with them at all. So it's absolutely not a case of any sort of volume or any commitments on the take-up of fibre we would find bad and unacceptable. On the contrary, there is just some that could stray into the territory that we would just need to be careful about.
And on your second question, I mean, look, I think success in 2031 is in that 70% of the country having, you know, a range of networks being built, and that's likely to look different in different places. Different networks will go to different places, might involve a range of different companies, including the ones you mentioned. But we're really confident, we're really encouraged by the commitments that a number of companies like CityFibre have already made. And so, you know, we think we've got a really good prospect of getting that 70% commercial build achieved.
Thanks.
Thanks very much. On to the next question. I think we have about another 10 minutes, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Great.
The next question is coming from the line of Adam Fox-Ramley from HSBC. Please proceed, your line is open.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the presentation this morning. I had a question firstly on Area 3, please, because in the original consultation document, you made reference to the £5 billion worth of government support for rural areas, but the current government budget only envisages £1.2 billion to be made available over the next 5 years. So I wondered if that had impacted your thinking at all, or whether that's really a kind of a separate topic. And then secondly, there have been big changes to the corporate tax regime in the UK. A fairly small question here, but those haven't been factored into your app calculation at this point, from what I can see. It is mechanically the next point that they can go in at the 2026 review, at the next review. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Look, on your first question, you're right. I mean, obviously this is very complementary what we're doing to what the government's doing, but we haven't sort of factored it in, because what we've done is a market analysis, and so that's at the heart of our approach. Lindsay, do you want to pick up the second question and expand on the first? I think we'll try and click through these last few questions as quickly as we can, so that we can allow as many as possible before 9:30.
Okay, certainly. So, I mean, firstly on Area 3, I mean, I think we've always been pretty clear that our objective here is to ensure commercial build firstly out to 70%, and then thanks to the Open Reach commitment on the 3.2 million, that's been able to be extended to 80%, and that government funding is going to be needed for that final 20%. It's obviously up to the government to then determine what pace they release that funding and their procurement approach. But as Melanie said, you know, we think this is really complementary to that. Dave, do you want to pick up the question on tax?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, clearly we did notice the corporation tax change in the budget, and we did actually put a note in our WACC annex when we discussed it. I mean, I'm not going to claim to be a WACC expert here, but you will see from our annex when we talk about WACC, there are loads of variables in there, and, you know, there's always a distribution. We did look at the recent change, and we sort of felt that where we were and other changes actually were also going through at the same time, we felt that the WACC that we was coming out with, particularly for Openreach, because as I said earlier, that's actually the only figure that we used to set any prices, we felt that it was in an okay place and we could run with that. But in terms of future WACC calculations, yeah, of course, absolutely, we would be looking at all of the factors that exist at the time, and again, looking at those distributions and coming up with, again, what we think is the right and fair WACC at that point in time. So, you know, the corporation tax at that point would certainly be reflected in it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Next question, if we may.
The next question is coming from the line of James Arthur from Anders Analysis. Please proceed, your line is open.
Hi, morning. I had a question about AltNet. If an AltNet builds out in a rural area where there's clearly only the economics for one full fibre network, what would you want to happen in that situation? And I can see there's Openreach might decide to build out on the grounds that it'll make money through increasing its overall regulatory asset base, and therefore kind of bankrupt that AltNet. Would you want it to do that, or would you want it to decide not to build and eventually withdraw copper, and would you even allow it to take that approach?
I think on that one, look, this is a competitive strategy and a strategy based on competition. So whilst we think it's a lot less likely that we'll get competition in Area 3, if an AltNet does build and then somebody else chooses to overbuild them, that's certainly not something that we'd be looking to stop or to prohibit. You know, I think, you know, what we want to do is give all the AltNets the best possible chance to succeed, but in a competitive environment. So we certainly wouldn't want to stop overbuilding Area 3 if it does happen.
Yeah, and I think you asked a question about copper switch off in there as well. So I'll just pick that up. You know, what we've set out, and again, it's in our copper retirement section, which is in volume 3. You know, if Openreach and other people wanted to overbuild, whether it's an Area 2 or Area 3, we don't mind. Equally, if Openreach decided that it didn't want to overbuild and it wanted to do some deal with the AltNet and close its copper network, that's also fine. And we've actually set that out explicitly that they could do that, and indeed we would support them in doing that. So it really becomes a commercial competitive choice at that point, and that is the framework that we're trying to set out at this point in time.
Understood. Thank you.
Next question.
Next question is coming from the line of Charlotte Perfect from Arete Research. Please proceed, your line is open.
Hello, hi, thank you. My question is around Area 3, just to understand a bit more there. Does the principle that is aligned to Area 2 in scope and level last beyond 2026? And if so, I mean, I guess what are the reasons for keeping Area 3 as Area 3? Does Area 3 just looks like Area 2, so why not just call it Area 2, all of it? What are the main differences there? Thank you.
Thanks, Charlotte. I'll pick up that one. So to some cases, it might sound a sort of bit arcane in the structure that we're dealing with, but here we are looking at the competitive conditions that exist across the UK. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that there are differences in competitive conditions, you know, between one end of the country and the other. And look, you know, we could all bicker about where the line's drawn, but it's got to be drawn somewhere. And what we are saying is, in Area 3, we do think that there is just substantially less prospects of sustainable competition, and therefore we do need to treat it differently. And of course, what we're ultimately after here is we're ultimately after consumers being protected or indeed getting a good deal. And in Area 2, we're comfortable that the competitive dynamic will ensure that they will get a good deal. In Area 3, we don't have that competitive dynamic, and hence the commitment given from Openreach is the way of ensuring that they do get the investment. And so that's what allows us to level up the two areas. In terms of Beyond 26, and again, we've set this out in the document, yes, it's our intention that we will keep them locked together. And that's because we believe, you know, looking at people's plans, that there will be continued rollout in Area 3 Beyond 26. We think there will be some commercial rollout, in fact, Beyond 26. But there will also be government intervention, certainly Beyond 26. And in fact, the question earlier about the 5 billion, but as we sort of know, 3.8 billion of that is going to be spent after 26, and that will be in Area 3. And whilst that's government funded, because the government funding is a gap funding model, it will actually draw commercial investment out during that period. And so on the basis that this is how we see the world playing out, we will want to keep Areas 2 and 3 in alignment.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Dave. Now, we've just got a minute left. I think we have two questions. Ben, I wonder if we can just very quickly ask both questioners, one after the other, to pose their questions, and then we'll come back to Ofcom one final time for the answers. So if we can just try and wrap up in a couple of minutes, but just give everyone a chance to ask the questions they have.
Ben?
Yes, the next question is coming from the line of Sam McHugh from Exane. Please see if your line is open.
Thank you, guys. I'll have two quick questions. On the long-term contracts, does your concern around the volume commitments extend to BT consumer contracts with Openreach, the first one? And then secondly, when it comes to assessing the target returns and fair bet on fibre, how should we think about the mean capital employed in FTTP? So if BT is spending £600 or so to invest in fibre, how much gets allocated to the PIA market versus, I guess, what will be some kind of new allocation in their regulated accounts for fibre? Thanks very much.
Okay, so on the long-term contracts and BT consumer, I mean, it depends what form they take, but I think my starting position would be that we'd probably have much less concern or probably interest in how they set them up. We'd have to look at the time clearly, but it's definitely not the focus of our regulation and certainly not the focus of this this review, which is completely at the wholesale level. On your second point, if I understood it correctly, this is any investments that actually BT and Openreach are putting into the network now that ultimately are that flow through to making the ducts and pole assets better. It's our intention to absolutely capture those. And indeed, in setting the charges for duct and pole access over the next 5 years, we've taken a forward-looking approach of exactly what sort of activity is going on in that network. And not surprisingly, with all the activity of deployment of fibre actually that we're seeing at the moment, there is more cost going into that network, and that is reflected in the prices that we've just set out.
If I can just follow up very quickly, sorry. So if I think about BT, they're talking about a £12 billion investment in fibre. So should we be thinking that that is the eventual mean capital employed that you'll be looking at for the kind of return, and then the economic depreciation is on that full amount, or will it be less than that, or are there other things that go into it? I don't know if you can add any clarity at all on that.
So the £12 billion, of course, is the total investment in the fibre network. Only a small portion of that would be flowing into the duct and pole access. because a big portion of it would clearly be the installation of the fibres and the fibre equipment and so on. So if we're talking about what flows into the ducts and pole price, it would be a portion, probably quite a small portion of that. If we're talking about the value, if we were to ever set cost-based charges for five services, then it would be the 12 billion.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Thanks very much. Look, although I think we have one last question, we will follow up with that person offline. I think we'd better wrap up now. But can I just thank everybody for joining us this morning. Thanks to my colleagues who are in Riverside House, I'm at home, for answering all the questions. Thanks to Rohit for organising it. And thank you, Ben, for comparing from your end. Look, I hope everyone enjoys kind of digesting the material, reading the document. We look forward to seeing your reactions. It's a big moment for us today, of course, but we really hope that this is a turning point and a real move forward on broadband investment. So thank you very much for joining us, and do follow up with any further questions that you have as well. We're very happy to answer anything that you have queries about. But meanwhile, good morning, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you, Melanie. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes your conference call for today. You may now disconnect. Thank you for joining, and have a very good day.